Good morning and welcome to Mound Money in Park City here on this wet morning, wet and cold. It's supposed to get a little bit nicer later in the week, though. This is Doug Wells. Larry Warren is on vacation in Paris, of all places. I've got a special co-host with us this morning. Barry Hanover is with me. He is a serial entrepreneur in the life science spaces. Barry, thanks for joining us this morning.
Doug, I'm really happy to be here. Thanks for inviting me.
Absolutely. We've got three interesting guests. Our first guest is going to be Orly Lobel. She just wrote the book, Talent Wants to Be Free, and she talks about the negative impacts of non-competes and non-solicits and restrictive covenants on employees. She has taught at Harvard Law School and Yale. She's done a lot of research in this area. She's written two books previously, so it'll be an interesting conversation.
Our second guest is Tom Caron. Tom is CEO of Moki Mobility. It's a company that allows companies to build and enable an app, manage operational capability for mission-critical apps, are apps that just have to work in order to make the company function properly. They put out a press release October 1st. They've raised $6.6 million in new funds, and we're going to talk about the fundraising and the company. The third guest is Nick Dunn, and Nick Dunn is Public Information Officer for Workforce Services. Apparently, the Utah Department of Workforce Services is an award-winning department. They won an award from the U.S. Department of Labor three times in a row, never happened before, and we're excited to talk to them about apparently an excellent department within Utah that most of us probably don't know much about.
That's right. All right, well, you're listening to Mound Money on KPCW, and we'll be back in a moment.
Please. I'm Mike Kinsinger, branch manager of U.S. Bank. U.S. Bank is pleased to offer continued support for our community radio. U.S. Bank is located right on the corner of Park Avenue and Deer Valley Drive. Our staff is available for your consumer and commercial banking needs, including both mortgages and investments. We're online at usbank.com. Our local number is 647-3726.
Welcome back to Mound Money. We've got with us Orly Lobel. As I mentioned earlier, she is a professor of law. She has taught at Yale and Harvard, as well as University of San Diego. She argues that we should allow our employees more freedom if they want to leave. That's a good thing for the ecosystem, and we should minimize the restrictions. Orly, thank you for joining us this morning.
Thank you for having me.
You know, I really like the way you start your book. You tell the story of Mark Zuckerberg and you know, the whole idea of restrictive covenants and who owns ideas. And I think it lays the groundwork and presents the landscape for this issue. Could you briefly tell us that story and lay out kind of the issue at hand here?
Yeah, so Mark Zuckerberg is a great example because we think we know what intellectual property is about, and we think we know that we struck a certain bargain in the Constitution and then in the Patent Act and the Federal Copyright Act. We know that there's a price to monopolizing some information, but we like to have patents because it incentivizes new innovation and incentivizes entrepreneurs. But with the Zuckerberg story, it's really we see this expansion under the radar of controlling ideas that would not lend themselves to patents. They would not lend themselves to copyright. Really, there's no claim with those Winklevoss brothers that he stole a patent or used trade secrets. It's really just about this idea that they had that nobody thought they can patent a social network. There were already social networks competing and in the market. And it's just about these creative capacities and inventive capacities of the people themselves. It's the litigation is just about Zuckerberg having agreed to do some work for them, but at the same time, he puts all his energies to competing with them. And so they think they have a stake in Facebook.
And I think, yeah, you've got another place in your book that lays the groundwork as well that kind of builds on it, which is the importance of innovation and the importance of this issue, because if we restrict our employees too tightly, we limit innovation. You talk about Obama sharing that innovation is the biggest challenge facing us right now, that he shares that China has the fastest trains and the fastest computers in the world, And if we're not careful, the U.S. is going to lose its lead in technology. Why does allowing employees more freedom to move, why does that help foster innovation?
Yeah, Obama talks about it as our new Sputnik. It's really, everybody agrees that the biggest asset in the next couple of decades is the talent that we have. It's not just the outputs of ideas, specific ideas, because innovation is so rapid that you really have to reskill and meet the next challenges, the next competition, the next global race for some new improvements, processes. And there is a concern. There's if you follow the immigration reform questions, really the high-tech companies kept saying, we don't have enough talent, we don't have enough brain power, we're losing in the global race for brain power. And the evidence supports this notion that if we are restricting people from moving across companies within the industry from one competitor to another, we are losing out on how to employ talent in the best way possible. And it's not only, it used to be that we would talk about non-competes as sort of a labor versus industry or businesses. Businesses want them, and then employees are, you know, want to be free. But the biggest argument here, and the research supports this, is that everybody's losing when we're restricting talent because people are not put to use where they are most effective, where they can learn the most. When there's no circulation, brain circulation within a market, there's much less knowledge that flows within that industry, and the industry is left behind. And in places where there's much more job mobility, intra-job mobility, and also more talent coming in from other places, it's just the industry as a whole moves together more rapidly.
Orly, I've been in R&D my whole life, and I have lived exactly what you're talking about, and I've worked in some great companies where there are a free flow of information and people. I can certainly understand that locally companies sharing, and we actually do some of that here. We have a very active medical device development and manufacturing industry in Utah, helps us compete with other states. I understand that California doesn't recognize non-competes. That gives them a great advantage. So state to state, even country to country. But if everybody shares worldwide, does it give the entire world a lift, or is this more about competing either locally, regionally, state to state, or country against country?
That's a great question. So when we researched California is just a great natural experiment that, unlike basically every other state in the United States, it has always had a very strong policy against non-competes. You're asking about how does it gain, what does it gain from it? Does it just gain from its comparative advantage or in and of itself from this policy? And we see that the gain is the double gain. So I think the Silicon Valley has been very self-conscious from the beginning. The big companies there, like IBM, at the beginning, they understood that there's an advantage for entire teams moving out of the company and starting up new companies, competing startups that seemed like they would be competitors, but it turned out that they were, a few years down the road, they became partners, they became collaborators, and the whole industry became, there was the Silicon Valley miracle because of that fluidity and because of that mobility. And California, though, gains twice because it really has the advantage of also luring people from other places. So there's actually really strong evidence empirically of people that are, for example, in Michigan, where they enforce strongly non-competes, the best scientists, the best people in R&D, when they want to leave, and they often want to leave a company, they're unsatisfied, they feel like they're not valued as they should be, they are actually lured by California employers. They're told, come to California, and here we won't enforce
And that's a great point. You know, Utah is fairly rigorous in their enforcement and non-competes as well. And I think it works against the state, unfortunately. We spend a lot of time to educate our youth. We spend a lot of effort to bring business here. And rather than successful entrepreneurs staying, maybe they were number two or number three at a successful company, oftentimes our best and our brightest have to leave the state because of the non-compete, which is a big, big price to pay. I think it's interesting that California's experience was actually an accident, right? They did not set out, as you point out in your book, they didn't set out to make these non-competes non-enforceable to foster innovation. It was from the beginning of the state being accepted in the union. That's always been their stance. But over time, we've seen the positive impact California has gotten from that.
Well, that's right. It's a big, in legal history debate, it's a big question of how much of an accident was this. Or maybe it was just, I would call it an intuition, a guess about how we want to have flow of knowledge. We want to have access. We want to have consumer choice. So that has to do with, people offering more services and people having this dream of we're going to work for 10 years for a company, but then we can also use all our expertise and everything that we gained to fulfill the dream of being independent, starting something on our own. But what happens in California is that more and more, and most excitingly, just the past 5 years, we have very strong, hard evidence that this experiment, this intuition, really paid off.
Well, when I first started reading the book, even though I agreed with your premise from the beginning because of some of the great companies that I've worked with, you might think that people move to California because it's sunny and there's warmth, and somebody would obviously move from Mission to California.
Good-looking girls.
Whatever. But you also had some good data on things that had changed in a particular environment. I think it was Michigan, where they had originally more open work environment for talent flow and then changed the laws, and you got to see the change there. Was it Michigan that I'm remembering?
It was Michigan, but there are other examples. Texas, at Hardin, their non-competes experienced a loss. And even what's cool about the empirics is that you can even compare between states that enforce non-competes. They all have this standard of reasonableness. No court will enforce a non-compete for 30 years of your life and across every possible remote competitive venture. So we use the standard of reasonableness in other states, and you can compare how courts actually enforce that, and so weaker enforcement versus stronger enforcement, and you see that even minute differences affect the region, affect economic growth. You see that even when, for example, some states have a standard that if you're firing your employees, you can't enforce a non-compete against them. That makes sense. If someone's leaving you, that maybe has some sense of their, taking your ideas and running off to the competition. But if you're firing them, how can you expect them to just, take some professional detour, sit on their, butt, if you can say that on radio, and not do anything? And so even those minute differences of a state that enforces less non-competes has made a great difference and great positive difference for that region.
So, Orly, we've probably got two groups in our audience listening this morning. One that are employees of companies, and everything we're saying is resonating with them. Of course, they want as much freedom as possible. And then we have the business owners. Park City is a community that people choose to live in, and we've got some heads of some Fortune 500 companies that live here at least part of the year. And some of those folks might be listening and saying, well, this is crazy. So make the case for us. How does it benefit the company by having this non-compete. Barry and I were talking in the green room ahead of time about the prisoner's dilemma that you mentioned in your book and how both firms benefit as long as they both do it. But share with our audience that, that framework.
Well, and in that response, also cover why some of these states went the opposite direction and, in fact, a counterproductive direction. Was it under pressure from local companies and apparently against their own best interest?
Yeah, so there's no denying that if you freeze the picture and at one moment when your best athlete leaves you and starts something new, you're going to frequently experience some loss. But the question is over time and as a repeat game, if you're in it for the marathon, not just the sprint, if you're a company who wants to be there and establish itself, establish a very strong presence in the market, you have to think about the repeat game. And there are other protections. This is really important for businesses. We're not talking about abolishing intellectual property. We're not talking about not having trade secret laws. So California does have trade secret protection. So if someone actually takes, you know, the best ideas or the best information that comes out from an R&D secret project, then you can go after them for that. But it just doesn't benefit someone to have an employee that's disgruntled, that's not satisfied, and is not leaving you because they can't, because they feel like, you know, they're going to be suing them. And companies develop reputations. Companies will always have to be recruiting, and that's good for everybody. It's good for a business to have new blood. All the evidence shows that the more new blood that comes to a team, the less stagnation we have, the more breakthroughs, the more fertilization of the people that are already there. So we want to have this ability to recruit. We want to have circulation in the market, and we don't want to have a reputation that we sue our former employees. We actually can learn how to use that movement, even if we experience it as a loss and momentarily. We can use our employee ex-employees that are out there in the world as a strength.
And Orly, I think what you're talking about there is the alumni groups that folks like McKinsey and Procter & Gamble have used so successfully. Can you share briefly a little bit about that?
Yeah, so I think more and more industry leaders are thinking, I would say a little bit like universities, thinking about their ex-employees as goodwill ambassadors that are out there in the world, in the region, that stay in touch with the company, that can present their perspective in lobbying efforts. They can present their perspective, the ex-employer's perspective, in industry and associations. They can help with new recruitment. They tell, you know, if they left with a good, you know, memory and with keeping up good relations with the business, they can tell others about how what a great workplace this is and send people your way. And eventually, also, there's a big understanding that there's a very good practice of boomerang hiring, of rehiring those people who left you and maybe saw that the grass is not greener somewhere else.
I believe, and you mentioned this, that it's a lot like personal relationships. If you spend time with somebody for a long period of time and then you break up and you remain friends and treat them well, you've got a much better chance of having a successful next relationship. This great company that I was with used to celebrate when employees chose to leave. If we had a long-term relationship, we'd have a party for them, regardless of the reason they were leaving of their own accord. And it created so much goodwill with the people that remained behind because they felt so valued that we had a great reputation.
Right, exactly. The studies, and I think we just all know this from experience, all show that people are looking for jobs that are beyond what they just get in their paycheck, the just dry salary. They're looking to build their careers. They're looking to build their networks. They're looking for continuous learning and professional development. And so they care about all these great signals, all the non-monetary goodies that a company can provide, their reputation, the ability to think about their career for the long term.
So, Orly, we've only got time for a couple more questions, and I know Barry wants to ask you a prescriptive question about what the state legislature here can do to foster more innovation and freedom of sharing ideas and employees. But I do want to lay the groundwork, because I think for a lot of people, they think it's crazy. As company owners, they think it would be crazy to not tie up their best employees and to not use non-competes. And I found one of the more compelling parts of your book is when you explain the impact on society, when you look at, for instance, a physician that you might have a relationship with that's working for a physician group, or an attorney that you're working with, and the impact of non-competes there, and in those two professional practices, the use of non-competes is very different. So before Barry asked about the prescriptive lease suggestions for the state of Utah, I wanted to get you to kind of lay that groundwork, because I think it illustrates the importance of allowing some additional freedom.
Yeah, so these learned professions, that we call them in law, are good examples of the cost to not only the industry, but also consumers and the clients. So I tell the story of someone who's been taking their kid to the same pediatrician from the day the child was born, and then one day they're told by the clinic that the physician moved across the street, but they can't continue seeing them, even though they are the people that there's the doctor that knows your child the most. You can't see them because the doctor signed a non-compete. And so the American Medical Association has been struggling and going back and forth. What should we do? Should we enforce non-compete? Should we have a rule as part of our professional ethics to not enforce non-competes? And they're ambiguous about what they think about this, because, again, of course, as someone who started up a clinic and has partners, you want to control all the patients that you introduce to your partners and not have them leave with them. But there's, I think that gives you a very straightforward idea of what the cost is for the public. And attorneys, actually, the ABA, the American Bar Association, has been very clear that, no, we don't enforce non-compete, because that relationship between attorney-client is just so important, confidential relations between them. It's just so sacred that we want to encourage people to leave with their attorneys. Wherever they go, they have that relationship. So we see these two professions struggling with this, but I think that if we just have a rule, a policy rule about not allowing these non-competes, everybody will gain. Everybody will experience some loss sometimes, but for the most part, they'll gain.
So, Orly, we have a unique situation here. We have a fairly high-tech environment, in particular the one I've been involved with, medical devices. We have a lot of great companies that don't actually compete directly with each other. They might compete for talent, but you're not concerned. For example, I worked in an x-ray company, about them going locally to another x-ray company, and people do love to live in Utah. They don't really want to leave necessarily once they're here. So my question is, with that environment, it seems like we're really ripe for this sharing. And what would you prescribe for Utah? Because I know the governor's office wants us to compete better. I know the University of Utah wants to foster companies out of the university technology. They're very, very active. What's the best way to affect this change, to let talent run free and foster this kind of innovative environment and help us compete better for talent and resources with the rest of the country and the world?
Yeah, so everybody's thinking about this. Every state wants to be, the next Silicon Valley. Every state wants to experience economic growth and compete. And Massachusetts is going through this right now. So the governor has just stated that he supports a new bill that will move us more to the California law about not enforcing non-competes. And so the legislator was going to vote on this, and I think that the Utah legislator should certainly take this very seriously and think about shifting on non-competes. There's also many other things. Startup policies are very much right now ripe, and it's a very active debate. So drawing the right lines with trade secrets, drawing the right lines with how do we control employees and how do we incentivize them. So we talked a lot about these sticks of, you know, restricting employees and not letting them leave. And then, as you said, the university is rightly concerned because people who know about this are likely to actually leave before they even start signing all these restricted covenants. But then we have to also think about how do we use all the carrots, all the positive incentives, performance-based incentives. And I think companies should learn more about that, about using stock options. It doesn't have to be major, but giving employees some stake in what they're doing in their R&D and their performance, it makes a huge difference. They feel they identify with the process, they become more loyal, and they just become more motivated.
Well, our guest this morning, Orly Lobel, she's the author of Talent Wants to Be Free. She's also the Herzog Professor of Law and a founding member of the Center of Intellectual Property Law and Markets at the University of San Diego. Orly, it's an important topic. We enjoyed the conversation. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. And as far as weather, we're going to have kind of more of what you see out the window there for the rest of today and tomorrow, a little more rain. And then it looks like, Barry, we're going to have some beautiful weather coming up for the next 5 or 6 days.
You're absolutely right.
All right. Well, we'll be back in a moment. Our next guest is going to be Tom Karen. He's the CEO of Moki Mobility. Stay tuned.
This is Craig McCarthy with the Park City Chamber Bureau. Joining the Chamber Bureau provides your business with lots of benefits, from business-to-business networking and promotional opportunities to access to our 1,000-plus membership database. Becoming a member of the Park City Chamber Bureau is a great investment for your business. Information on joining is online at visitparkcity.com or call us at 649-6100. The Park City Chamber Bureau is a nonprofit organization.
Hi, I'm Kelly from San Francisco Design, longtime supporter of KPCW. We provide a mix of European and mountain contemporary home furnishings for a unique Park City lifestyle. Our showrooms are in Park City and Salt Lake, and both offer complete design services. We're on the web at sanfrandesign.com.
Our next guest on Mountain Money is Tom Karen, CEO of Moki Mobility. I mentioned in the opening of the show that Moki Mobility is an app management and operational capability company for mission-critical mobile apps. And on October 1st, they had a press release. They're in Salt Lake City, and they announced $6.6 million raised in additional funds. Tom, are you there?
Yes, good morning. How are you?
Hi, Tom. It's nice to meet you. I'm also an entrepreneur in Salt Lake, and I'm surprised we haven't met at some point, although we're in very different businesses. I wanted to ask you a couple of questions. First of all, obviously, an overview of the company, exactly what your company's products are. But even before that, tell us a little bit about the fundraising round. $6.6 million into the state is very substantial. What are your plans for use of those funds? What are your plans for growing business here in Utah versus elsewhere? And then an overview of what the company does.
Excellent. Well, we were very pleased to announce the funding. Paleon Ventures in Salt Lake City led that funding round for us. We also had Allegis Capital in the Bay Area and Epic Ventures, which was involved in our previous funding, also came through on that funding. So it was a great opportunity for us to bring a substantial amount of money into the business, primarily to grow our operation here in Utah. We currently employ 29 employees here in Utah, and we plan to add about 20 more by the end of the year. So primarily the funds are going to be used to grow our marketing, sales, and engineering capabilities here in the state.
Well, we should probably add, I know Greg Warnock and Alan Hall, it's Founders 550, is that the name of his fund? I know they participated as well.
Yeah, so Plus 550 came
Plus 550.
There's a host of really venerable entrepreneurs, including Greg Warnock and many others that are involved in Plus 550. So we were also very pleased to have them join in helping fund Moki.
Absolutely. And I also understand Rick Alden, a local hero here, founder of Skull Candy, and Josh James down in Utah County as well came in.
That's right. They're involved in Plus 550, and so therefore in our funding round.
So what is the problem that you help your customers solve?
The problem that we help our customer resolve is related to a new trend in mobility. One of the first things that happened, with this new mobile revolution was a lot of consumer applications were created. It was a consumer device primarily, talking about the iPhone and Android devices. So we saw a lot of games and interesting, applications that came out that for consumers. What we believe an important new trend is that businesses, in fact, we believe almost every business is now producing a mobile application. If you think about 20 years ago, and you think about your bank, the most important experience that you had at your bank typically took place at the bank or in the lobby of the bank. And 10 years ago, perhaps that customer interaction transitioned to the bank's website. And today, most of the customer interaction and a lot of the new customer interaction with your bank happens via mobile devices. So we believe that the trend that is happening in mobile right now is that businesses are now taking mobile very seriously, and they're looking for ways to mobilize out to their customers. In doing so, they're creating a lot of what we call mission-critical apps, which are applications that are transactional. Maybe they transact money, or you're doing some sort of business over the mobile device with the application. And businesses need more visibility into how those mission-critical applications are working in the field. They also need to be able to provide support when there is a problem with the mobile application. They need to be able to provide support to the end user to help them get it up and running. So what Moki Mobility provides is a platform and some embeddable technology to companies to embed with their mobile applications so that we can provide enhanced visibility, some control at the application level, and also security in these mission-critical scenarios for mobile applications.
So is it fair from a high level, obviously right now app development's a hot space, and you're not actually developing apps. You're, to use the analogy of the gold rush in California, you're selling the picks and shovels to the gold miners that are taking place. Is that a fair analogy?
That's exactly right. We don't develop the applications for the businesses. We provide them with the tools that they need to be successful in their endeavors in publishing their own mission-critical applications.
Successful and secure, I guess. You talk about being the first one to really allow them to manage point of sale on personal devices and tablet kiosk. I'm assuming since those activities have been going on for a while that there's been some problems that companies have been having that you're trying to solve.
Yes, that's a great point. We have hundreds of customers that have engaged Moki Mobility who've tried, on their own to publish their mobile applications. And, to some extent, they've been very successful in dealing with the business items that they want to take care of, which typically are the interaction with their company. The things that they may not be as expert at are security and control. And so that's where Moki comes in. We can provide expertise that's aligned with what they're trying to do, but not necessarily solving the exact problem that they're trying to solve.
So, Tom, tell us a little bit about your story. Utah is a very entrepreneurial state. We have a lot of folks listening that are either currently entrepreneurs or desire someday to be an entrepreneur. Are you the founder of the company? And if so, how did you come up with the idea? And how is what you're doing today, how does that compare to what the original idea was back when you founded the company?
Great question. I'm the co-founder. So, my business partner, Ty Allen, he and I started the company early in 2012. And, you know, I am a serial entrepreneur. I have a technology background. I got a CS degree at BYU in 1996. And I've worked in several different areas of technology as an engineer, you know, as a manager, and also as an entrepreneur. Moki Mobility is actually my third company that I've started in the state. One of the companies that I started, Wingate Web, which was an online events management technology with my co-founder, Ty Allen, back in 1998. We built that business up over a period of 10 years and sold it to a technology company that was based out of San Diego called the Active Network. After we did that, we looked around and we were trying to figure out what the next thing that we could do would be. And, you know, this was 2009 when mobile was really just taking off and scaling. So we spent a few years consulting and just working with businesses and helping them to understand, you know, what the issues around mobile were. And after a few years of consulting, we got this idea that, you know, all of the companies that we were working with faced some of the similar kinds of problems with visibility and control and security. And, you know, we could create another technology company and that Utah would be a great place to do it to help, you know, businesses attack this problem of making their apps more successful. So that was kind of the genesis of it and a little bit of background on me.
You talked a little bit about the personal use devices. I think the other portion of your business revolves around managing the purpose devices, kiosks and tablets that we see in malls and stores and other places where people can either enter information or do transactions. You want to talk a little bit about that? I was particularly interested in your management application, the ability to broadcast, manage, collect data. It seemed extremely valuable. We hear, Doug and I, in Park City Angels about companies that want kiosk-based businesses, but they really don't have this management capability.
Yeah, thank you. So we found that businesses typically want to go to market with one of or two business models. One of the possible ways that you can take an app or a solution to market is to provide the whole experience. You know, you put your application on a purposed or dedicated device, and you put it out in a retail or a restaurant environment. And that is what we call the purpose device market. And that is an enormous growing market. There's a trend where old proprietary hardware or PCs or complicated systems can easily be replaced by a $500 iPad. The challenge is when you do something like that, if you're a business and you're going to deploy 500 kiosks, you know, in a hotel lobby or in a restaurant, you've got a distributed problem where those devices are distributed out across geographical locations and networks. So Moki provides a management platform and technology as well as a kiosk application to enable businesses, if they do want to go to market via dedicated devices, to have full management of those devices. And if they put an application on those devices, to have the management and control of the application on those devices as well. We're seeing in retail a huge trend to use mobile devices in place of old proprietary hardware.
Well, I can see why you guys had success at your funding and why you guys are getting traction. It is a big problem, and you're on the forefront of the issue. We only have time for one last question, and I want to go back for the other entrepreneurs, for the entrepreneurs that are listening. Talk to us about your decision on the investment partners to take on. Obviously, you had a success before you started Moki Mobility. You're in an interesting space. You're doing well. So I'm guessing you had your choice of which investors you wanted to have in the fund. How did you choose who to allow in?
Well, you know, we wanted to work with people that caught the vision, you know, of businesses mobilizing to their customers. That was the core vision that we wanted our investors to agree with. We found in Paleon and Allegis and Epic and Plus 550 a group of investors that had early stage funds that were going to be focused specifically on this market. And one of the things that we knew that was going to be very important was we were going to need additional funding. This Series A is a very large tranche. It's a great investment. But companies in our space are very well funded. So we knew that we were going to have investors that also had a lot more dry powder and that shared the vision that this was going to require a lot of growth to fully maximize this opportunity. So this group of investors that we've pulled together, they've got backing, and they can help us achieve our goals today and help us bring in additional funds in the future as we grow to become a very large company.
And Tom, Barry and I know, at least I know three out of the four, and I'm sure Barry knows at least three out of the four. I've heard of Allegis. I don't know them personally, but I think you chose wisely. Those are some top-tier firms that are going to help not only provide the capital you need, but also the advice and counsel to help build a successful company. So, Tom, thank you for joining us. Our guest is Tom Caron. He's the CEO of Moki Mobility, based in Salt Lake City. Just raised a very successful round, a very interesting space. Thank you for joining us.
It was a pleasure. Thank you for your time today.
And stay tuned. We'll be back in a moment.
Tune in to KPCW every Tuesday morning at 9 to hear This Green Earth.
We'll cover environmental issues from local to global, from snowpack to giant squid,
geothermal energy to gray wolves,
and honeybees to sustainable chocolate. Brought to you by Jones, Waldo, Holbrook, and McDonough,
Republic Services,
Habitat for Humanity's Restore,
and Rocky Mountain Power.
Juniper Landing is proud to support our local radio station, KPCW. Juniper Landing is a new, whole ownership townhome community located at the base of Canyons Resort, adjacent to the Waldorf Astoria Park City, with a model open daily. Our website is juniperlandingparkcity.com.
Underwriting on KPCW is supported by Mountain West Bank in Park City, a community bank offering home financing service and guidance. Mountain West Bank is located near Kearns Boulevard next to the movie theater. More information at mountainwestbank.com. Division of Glacier Bank, member FDIC, equal housing lender.
Park City Realty Group is proud to support KPCW. Park City Realty Group has provided real estate services to buyers and sellers since 2005. Our team shares local knowledge and insight with clients who value the Park City lifestyle. Knowledge plus hard work equals success. 649-1991 or parkcityrealtygroup.com.
Additional funding for programming on KPCW has been provided by Long Reimer Weiniger Bepler, Estate Planning, Family Law, LRW-LAW.com. Park City Nursery. For 30 years, we know what grows. ParkCityNursery.com. VaultHomeLoans.com. Purchase and refinance mortgages. Conventional FHA and VA, 801-201-3484. The Corporation for Public Broadcasting and listeners like you.
Welcome back to Mountain Money. We're going to have Nick Dunn join us in a couple seconds here. He is the Information Officer for Workforce Services. And Barry, as you know, we're in day 14 of this government shutdown, which is, to me, unbelievable. What do we have till Thursday until Jack Lew says we're out of money?
That's right. We'll be able to pay two-thirds of our bills. That's pretty good.
And so Nick is going to join us. Nick, I understand you're on the phone. Is that correct?
Yes. Good morning, Barry and Doug. How are you guys?
Good morning. Sorry, we had a little phone challenges here at KPCW, but we've got them figured out now. So, Nick, you're going to talk to us about what the impact of the government shutdown has been on the local economy and on unemployment. Is that correct?
Yeah. The kind of the biggest initial impact we've been seeing is on unemployment. Our department runs unemployment insurance, and so when people get laid off or furloughed, they apply through us for those temporary benefits. And that's kind of the biggest impact we've seen so far. Since the shutdown on October 1st, we've received more than 8,000 claims for unemployment benefits. And that's about two or three times the normal amount. And so we're definitely seeing a significant increase there. And based on our data, it looks like about two-thirds of those claims are federal employees who have been furloughed because of the shutdown.
That's awful. You know, it really brings home the impact of this. Larry and I were talking last week about, you know, our politicians should be making it easier for entrepreneurs like Tom Caron and other people here to be growing their business and hiring. And instead, right now, they're an impediment, and it's really a shame.
Yeah, you know, it's one of those things that we, especially here in Utah, I mean, you guys know the numbers we've been seeing for a while since the recession. Utah has really been able to grow quite significantly since the recession. You know, we've been beating most other states in terms of job growth numbers, and our unemployment rate has been consistently lower than the other states. And so when we look at how well we're doing in Utah, and then as a result of some federal uncertainty and different situations that kind of hamper our ability as a state to grow. It's just one of those situations where you of course hope there's a quick resolution to all this so we can kind of get back on track.
So, Doug, I appreciate the problem. Utah, I believe, the federal government is our number one employer in Utah. It's a huge problem here, maybe even more so than in other states. Your department has been recognized for being able to process these claims very rapidly and efficiently. And, in fact, I think people ought to know that we have a department that really excels. You've received an award from the Utah Department of Labor 3 times in a row that's never been done. Can you tell us something about that, especially in a time when maybe government employees aren't getting the appreciation they deserve?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, as I said, when we have 2 or 3 times the normal amount of unemployment insurance claims coming in, that's significantly higher volume than we normally deal with. And so the award we won was for our unemployment insurance division, and it's called the Triple Crown, and it's given out by the U.S. Department of Labor at a national meeting for unemployment insurance directors. This one was in South Dakota. And so basically what this award looks at is it looks at your unemployment insurance program, and it looks at how quickly you can process claims and how accurately you can divvy up benefits. And it basically ranks the different states in terms of unemployment programs. And among medium-sized states like Utah, we've taken first in that. And this is the 3rd year in a row. So each function that our unemployment insurance division performs, you have appeals, decisions, and tax operations are kind of the 3 main things. Each of those functions, Utah takes the cake. We beat every other state in our category, and it is the 3rd year in a row. It's one thing just to say, well, we won some government award, and that's nice. But I think the impact for Utahns is that the unemployment insurance program is something that all states run to help employees when they've been laid off or furloughed. But the importance of this award is that this is one of the best run programs in the nation. We have it right here in Utah. You go to other states, and if you're talking to other administrators, they say, hey, you're from Utah. You guys have that really good unemployment insurance program. And the reason it matters is because not only are we able to process these claims and administer the program effectively during normal times with a normal caseload, but during extraordinary times, like right now, we're still able to process this well. And so we're very fortunate that we don't have to close down our unemployment insurance program. So you have those thousands of federal workers who have been furloughed, they can come to the Department of Workforce Services and know that, hey, I'm going to be okay. I'm going to get my unemployment insurance benefits, and I'm going to be able to be covered until I can get back on my feet when the federal government gets everything sorted out.
Well, Nick, that is good news. I'm glad to see that that the Department of Workforce Services has created those systems to be able to provide that level of service to folks that are going through a very difficult time in their lives. And I think it's easy. The last 2 years, the economy is getting better. Many of us knew people in 2008 and 2009 that lost their jobs, maybe they had to sell their house and leave the state, which was very challenging. But the last 2 years, really, things have been getting better by the day, I think. And we forget that there still are people losing their jobs and getting laid off. And just remind us, I don't know the details, and I'm sure you do, but when a person loses their job in Utah, what's the average amount of time that they're out of work until they find their next job?
I don't remember the exact number, but it's actually a lot shorter than most states. It's in usually within a few weeks or months, people are able to find something again. We kind of look at everything in terms of whether it's food stamps or unemployment insurance or basically any of our temporary assistance programs. And the duration is generally pretty quick. There's a pretty good turnover in Utah, especially compared to other states. And I think we can attribute that to the centralized way we administer all those programs, but it's also coupled with efforts to help people find a job. And so when somebody comes into our department, whether it's unemployment or food stamps or whatever other temporary assistance program they're asking for, we also connect them with resources to help find a new job. Maybe they need some retraining, some resume workshops, or some interview skills. Just kind of helping connect them with those resources and move them back into employment as quickly as we can.
Well, Nick, we need to wrap up, but thank you so much for your service and for your department services. I don't know if most people understand, but this is true insurance that people have paid for, and they deserve this kind of service, and we appreciate it. We've been speaking with Nick Dunn, Public Information Officer for the Utah Department of Workforce Services, and we appreciate your time. You're listening to Mountain Money on KPCW, and we'll be back in a moment. Please stay tuned.
Come find out where the candidates stand on the issues which are important to you. Join KPCW and the Park Record for this candidate forum on Tuesday, October 22nd at the Egyptian Theater. A social with free food and beverages starts at 6:30. The questions start at 7 with plenty of time for you to ask yours. Join us for a fun and informative evening. If you can't be there, tune into KPCW for the live broadcast. That's Tuesday, October 22nd at 7 p.m.
Thanks to our election forum sponsors, the River Horse on Main, Wasatch and Squatters Beer, the Egyptian Theater, and Tesh Law Offices.
Welcome back to Mountain Money. Those were very interesting guests and interesting conversations. Barry, before you and I get to kind of wrapping up, I want to make sure we take time to thank our sponsors for this show. We wouldn't be able to do Mountain Money without the support of these great sponsors. Park City Realty Group. I understand Kristen Egan just joined there, so congratulations to you, Kristen. Mountain West Bank, Iron Mountain Group, the Park City Chamber, Prudential Real Estate, and San Francisco Design. Thank you again, folks, for sponsoring the show. We certainly appreciate it. So, Barry, you and I were talking in the green room. You've been a serial entrepreneur most of your life, and you've never signed a non-compete, which surprised me and I think is a good thing.
That's correct. I actually walked away from one time in a very odd situation. I had worked for a company actually in charge of R&D for 9.5 years. I knew as much as anybody about the business of this company. We were acquired by a larger company, and after a year and a half, I decided to leave. And when I decided to leave, I offered to come back occasionally, even an hour a year, in order to help them with their product plans and just to add some history and knowledge to it. And this acquiring company said I had to sign a non-compete to come in and help them. And this is, an area where I wasn't coming in as a fresh consultant and they were going to teach me about their secrets. I was trying to help them hold on to their secrets and their history. So, of course, I walked away and never offered that service. But in general, the companies I've been with, we started a company after I left there, and our lawyers gave me an employee agreement, which included the normal patent assignment and things like that. But
they wanted you to have employees sign.
Well, that they recommended, and right. It had a non-compete in it, and I struck it.
Good for you. That's hard to do.
Well, it's not hard to do. It was a startup company, and I knew the kind of people we wanted, and I knew that by creating the right environment in these companies, these people would want to work here. And if they left, they'd probably figure out they wanted to come back and come back with new knowledge. So I had no problem with that.
You were talking earlier about the value of relationships and how do you end relationships in the right way, and I think that speaks to that issue. I want to go back to another point. We've only got a minute left, so I hope I get both of them in. First, I wanted to thank you again for joining us. Larry's on vacation in Paris. I hope he and his wife, Carol, are having fun. But, Barry, the reason I asked you to come in is I wanted the audience to benefit seeing our guests through the eyes of somebody that's a practitioner out there, a professional out there, and working to create businesses and create jobs. And I think we have another minute before we go to break. Just briefly, Barry, what are you doing now?
Well, Doug, you and I have both been members of Park City Angels. I think that's how we got to know each other.
It is, yes.
And after I left this last company I was involved with, which was Breast Imaging, I joined that group and I took a few years of voluntary unemployment. And I kind of looked around at the various companies we saw, and finally I was exposed to one about 4 weeks ago, 6 weeks ago. A young doctor and a patent attorney had started, Brandon Rosenhan and Andrew Hansen, and it is a very simple medical device, and they asked me to be their CEO. And so I'm entering kind of the new world of non-capital equipment, simple medical devices. It's a safety scalpel, And I absolutely feel like a kid in this business. I am learning so much about so many different things. And, of course, I have some experience in some areas. But simple disposable medical devices and sales, I learn something new every day. It's been terrific.
Well, great. And that company is lucky to have you joining their ranks. And, well, Larry and I will have to have you come on as a guest and tell us more about it later. You're listening to Mound Money on KPCW, 91.9 FM. NPR News is next.